This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are two ways to look at the news about Microsoft and Yahoo. One is that Microsoft didn't get to be what it is by taking no for an answer. The other is that they must be really desperate to go back with another offer after walking away. Micro who? Yahsoft? What's it going to be? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, committed to writing about issues that matter and the connections between them. The Economist, see the world differently. At newsstands and economist.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It is the 19th of May, and here's what we know for sure about the new Microsoft overture to Yahoo. Yeah, that's it. Nothing. All Microsoft will say is that it would be a, quote, transaction that falls short of an outright acquisition. Yahoo says it's open to talking about a transaction. So what do you suppose it could be? Something about search, probably. Advertising, almost definitely. Starring Google as the evil empire is a good bet, too. So since we are just throwing around ideas here, why don't we have Marketplace's Jeff Tyler consider some of the possible permutations?
Microsoft looks to be after Yahoo's search business and a minority stake in the company. That would give Microsoft a bigger piece of the $20 billion online advertising market. The move could also be defensive. Yahoo has been talking to Google about a deal where Yahoo would display search ads sold by Google. Gary Arlen is a tech industry analyst.
One of the opportunities is for Microsoft to acquire the pieces it needs to really go head-to-head with Google and, more importantly, keep Google away from Yahoo.
Billionaire Carl Icahn may help keep Google away from Yahoo. As a big shareholder, Icahn has been pushing Yahoo to reconsider Microsoft's merger offer. But even if Microsoft and Yahoo do combine forces, it may not be enough to slow Google.
It rarely turns out that if you take a couple of also-rans and put them together, that you beat the champion.
That's Bob Monroe, associate professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. He thinks a Yahoo-Microsoft partnership would flop if its only purpose is to challenge Google at what it does best, search-related advertising. But Monroe sees huge potential in developing the next generation of ads on sites like YouTube and MySpace.
Instead, if they could find a way to target video ads the way Google currently does targeted keyword advertising, but actually insert different ads for different viewers, that's where I think there's a really interesting opportunity, but nobody's really figured out how to do that right yet.
Monroe doubts a Yahoo-Microsoft combination will pose a strong threat to Google. He expects new competition will come from a startup company nobody's heard of yet. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There is another largely speculative story floating around out there. The one about whether or not the economy might manage to skate by without going into a recession. It's a classic economist story featuring lots of on the one hand, on the other hand developments. Today, for instance, an index of leading economic indicators rose when it had been expected to fall. But then again, on the other hand, if you will, there's a survey out today predicting weak growth for the rest of the year. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to find out who's right.
Six of the conference board's 10 indicators rose. Stocks went up, more houses were built. Time to party, right? Oops, put that beer down. The indicators that fell, they're pretty important. The number of hours worked fell sharply, and consumer spending was down. Ottoman Azildirim is an economist at the Conference Board.
There are still some clouds in the horizon. It may just be a temporary let up.
Or we may be headed back into an economic hurricane. The Conference Board only looks up to 6 months out. The National Association of Business Economists looks farther into the future. It says the outlook for economic growth is weak for this year and next. Northern Trust economist Paul Casbriel says we're in the eye of the storm.
When we do start to see the blue skies, they really aren't going to be that blue for some time. I think we're going to see gray skies even after the worst of the hurricane is behind us.
Economist Brian Bethune of Global Insight says any glimmer of blue sky is due to temporary factors, the economic stimulus package for one, and it expires at the end of this year.
If you combine that with the higher gasoline prices, then that could, in fact, cause the economy to contract in the first quarter of 2009.
Bethune says it's definitely not time to party. The consensus on our economic future is a big old let's wait and see. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This being Monday, the weekend box office numbers are in. The new Narnia movie is big. Iron Man is still hot. Speed Racer, though, has sunk. It was supposed to be a blockbuster. Warner Brothers put $100 million into making it, then another $150 million marketing it. Total box office take so far, less than $30 million. And all those Speed Racer Happy Meals and action figures may not pay off as planned either. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports now on the economics of a flop.
Speed Racer, the movie, rated PG, is now in theaters and at McDonald's.
Happy Meals are among Speed Racer's $80 million worth of promotional partnerships. General Mills put Speed Racer action figures in cereal boxes. There's a Speed Racer Lego set, and Puma made Speed Racer shoes. So what happens to all of that stuff when the movie crashes and burns? Consumer retail consultant Bert Flickinger.
Retailers will start canceling orders. So a lot of it will wind up in the closeout markets and in the off-price markets at deep discount.
And this couldn't have come at a worse time. Flickinger says companies are already slashing their marketing budgets. And when a big-ticket movie like Speed Racer fizzles out after just a few weeks, it highlights how expensive and dicey movie deals can be.
Yes, some of the sponsors say it's too high cost and it's too high of a risk with too little reward. It could change studio sponsorship and finance for the foreseeable future.
Flickinger says this may be the dawn of the movie make good, with studios compensating marketers for poor turnout by giving them discounts on future promotional deals. But LA Magazine's Mark Lachter says box office performance is only one part of a movie's marketing payoff.
Overseas box office, the DVD sales. So just because a film doesn't do as well as expected in the first few days doesn't mean it's going to be a total disaster from a financial standpoint.
And those tossed-aside toys and shoes, they can find new takers when the movie opens internationally.
Move it, Speed. It's getting ugly out there.
I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Everything was going along swimmingly for traders today, and then they checked the oil markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Political and economic unrest in the southern part of Africa have been centered for the most part in Zimbabwe in recent months. There's a runoff election there at the end of June. But millions of Zimbabweans aren't waiting around to see what happens. They have fled to South Africa, where brutal riots in Johannesburg have brought those economic and political problems out into the open. Gretchen Wilson covers Africa for us. She is based in Johannesburg. Hello, Gretchen.
Hi there, Kai.
Gretchen, set the scene for us. What's been happening this weekend and today in Johannesburg?
Well, tension has been brewing for really more than a week, but really things erupted this weekend, especially yesterday. There were a number of largely young men who were oftentimes drunk, who were roaming streets of the townships around Johannesburg and in Johannesburg city center. They're attacking undocumented immigrants, including Zimbabweans, Mozambicans, people from the Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 22 people have been murdered in this anti-immigrant violence, according to police. Police also say that about 10,000 people have been displaced from their homes and are seeking shelter in community centers. Today in Johannesburg, the Central Business District is very tense. It's largely closed for business. You have metal security gates covering the majority of storefronts. And so right now the police presence is spread very thin around the city. At midday today, I saw a lot of guys gathering at street corners. Some of them were carrying sticks. And I saw a lot of groups of young men running, carrying computers, televisions, TVs, and looking over their shoulders. No one was really there to stop them.
Why are these gangs targeting the foreigners?
Well, certainly the conditions that foster this kind of violence are economic. I talked to Dale McKinley today. He's a political analyst who's witnessed the violence over the past several days.
I think, first of all, the underlying factor here is an accumulation of desperation in poor communities. Conflict arises out of such a situation, out of such desperation.
South Africa is, it's really experienced a lot of healthy economic growth since the end of apartheid in 1994. But the growth really hasn't created a lot of jobs. So the unemployment rate remains at around 40%, and a lot of South Africans are still desperately poor. And then you add to that millions of poor African migrants seeking economic opportunity in Johannesburg. So you've got massive urbanization and millions upon millions of people desperately scrambling for really scant resources like jobs and housing.
So this is the poor attacking the poor.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Where does this story go from here then? It's not like refugees won't keep coming from Zimbabwe and Mozambique, and the economic situation in South Africa is still dire for many of them.
It's really difficult to say where this is going to go from here. Right now, many immigrants here in South Africa, who really form, in many ways, a backbone of this economy, are panicked. I think a lot of people say that these clashes are being orchestrated. No one really knows exactly what's happening, but pretty much every analyst, every official I spoke to said, look, this cannot be something that's so random. There's a tinderbox of economic unease, but the fact is this is being orchestrated by some factors, and no one really knows exactly what that is. And so until that is figured out, until the police can kind of get control of the situation, I think we're going to see this kind of violence escalating. As soon as night falls these days, people start to wonder what's going to happen next and where it's going to flare up next.
Gretchen Wilson in Johannesburg, South Africa. Gretchen, thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
China has begun 3 days of official mourning for the victims of last Monday's earthquake. The official death toll is now just over 34,000 people, although the government says that is certain to rise. Business losses are said to be approaching $10 billion. Millions of migrant workers from Sichuan province, where the epicenter was, who've left home to find work in cities to the east, are trying to decide what to do. Should they go back home to help, or stay where they are, keep working, and just send money? From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Half a dozen workers stare at a TV screen inside an 8-foot by 8-foot apartment in a Shanghai migrant shanty town. They're from the quake region of Sichuan, so they're scanning the screen for familiar faces, dead or alive. 41-year-old He Zhouying just got off the phone with her 16-year-old daughter back home, who has been sleeping in a makeshift tent amid the rubble. By herself.
She called and broke my heart. She said other kids' parents are taking care of them. Why aren't you here? I told her, I'm trying so hard to get home, but can't get a train ticket.
He makes $5 a day washing dishes at a restaurant. Sitting next to her, Hong Qiusheng is a security guard from the same village. His house, same story.
It's so tilted. Everyone's scared to go in. My wife and I have worked 10 years to build this house. In a few seconds, it was gone.
Hong wants to go home too, but landslides have blocked the train tracks. So he waits, along with 20 million Sichuan migrants sprawled all across China. It's easy to find them. The men turn up at most construction sites, and women work factory jobs, making microwaves, TVs, and cell phones. David Dollar heads the China team at the World Bank.
It'd be very surprising if any American household didn't have some appliance or clothing that had been assembled with the labor from someone from Sichuan.
Sichuan is poor and has little arable land. It exports more workers than any other province. And very often, Chinese migrants earn 5 times more than they would back in the countryside.
It's the biggest movement of people ever, I'm pretty sure. The numbers are just so big, I don't see how there can be any previous movement on this scale.
Back in the shanty town, dishwasher He Zhuying speaks to a relative on her cell phone. But moments later, the line goes dead. Her husband says they won't know the real situation until they actually go back home and see the wreckage.
If the government helps out, we can fix our house. If not, our daughter won't have anywhere to stay. So we'll bring her to Shanghai to find a job.
He and her husband actually have two kids. This violates the one-child policy. When their younger child was born, local officials showed up at their house. They fined her $100 and then sterilized her.
I'm glad I have two kids. If I only had one and the child got sick, that'd be it. Many kids who died in the earthquake were only children. I told my husband if I were the parent, I'd rather stop living and just die.
Every day last week, He biked to the train station to check on tickets. Finally, on Saturday, the tracks were clear. She and five hometown friends bought tickets for $140 round trip. That's about 1 month's salary. They plan to leave Tuesday and will travel for 40 hours. Construction worker Wang Youping will also be on board the train.
A colleague just found out he lost his house and all four of his family members. He left this morning and didn't even wait for his paycheck.
Before heading home, many migrants perform one last errand. They shop for new clothes. It may sound odd since they're returning to bury loved ones and rebuild houses. But to them, it's important to project the image of a hometown son or daughter who went to the big city and made good. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got pictures of one of those migrant families posted on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, where business meets baseball.
In the innovation game, which is a risky game, more at-bats leads to more hits. It's sort of the Pete Rose approach, okay, to innovation.
It's another conversation from the corner office, actually, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up a third of 1% today, 41 points to close at 13,028. The Nasdaq lost half a percent, 12 points to close at 2516. The S&P 500 basically flat up, basically just a point, ended the day at 1426. Railroads were the engine driving the Dow today after analysts recommended the sector. CSX Corporation chugged up more than 2%. Union Pacific, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe Corporation, and Norfolk Southern all gained steam today. Goldman Sachs added Amazon to its conviction buy list, and investors bought with conviction. The online retail giant clicked up more than 7.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for April. Presidential primaries take place in Kentucky and Oregon. And the Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on protecting the constitutional right to vote for all Americans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you're a lobbyist with ties to, say, foreign countries or commercial interests, John McCain's presidential campaign is probably not the place for you. A strict new policy on those outside associations has led to a number of departures from the campaign over the past couple of days. But not all political candidates are so gun-shy about their corporate connections. In fact, some are specifically recruited by business lobbying groups, as Judith Smelzer reports now from WMFE in Orlando, Florida.
Business Force. It may sound like a superhero movie for the CPA set, but it's actually a political action committee for Orlando's Chamber of Commerce. Chamber consultant Mark Mills says lately the quality of candidates asking for its support has been, well, unimpressive.
Many of them either don't have the leadership skills once they're elected, don't have a clue as to how to run a campaign, and don't have an idea about the critical issues facing our region.
Business Force is trying to change that. Earlier this year, it launched a training institute for potential candidates, but the selection committee wasn't looking for just any political wannabes.
We're looking for people who have a background in business, who would be able to take what they've learned in business, fiscal responsibility, what it takes to create jobs, take those skills with them to the public level.
The chosen participants were treated to a 2-day free seminar on the basics of running a campaign. It was paid for by several corporations, including AT&T, Outback Steakhouse, and Orlando's three major theme parks. Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida. He says it's usually political parties that do candidate training.
Interest groups, including business groups, traditionally are political organizations that band together just to try to influence public policy, not so much to actually train people to run and win elections. And so I think that's what's somewhat interesting about this particular situation.
Morning. I'm going to have your small cafe mocha.
Okay. Do you want whipped cream on top of your mocha?
Yes, please.
28-year-old Christina Dixon is one of the participants in the Business Force Institute. Today, she's meeting for coffee with her mentor in the program, Dori Madison. Both women are Republicans. The Institute is nonpartisan, though, and Dori says Business Force doesn't try to set the agenda for their meetings.
I mean, nobody on the Business Force board said, okay, these are the issues you're going to cover. It depends on the candidate.
As a civil engineer, one of Christina's interests is land development, and she thinks businesses could teach the public sector a thing or two.
They move so much faster. And it's not that the public can't eventually get there. It's just they have so many different steps and processes that they have their hands tied with. The developers can help facilitate that and push it along and try and get things going a little bit faster.
Those views from a would-be political candidate may be music to the ears of the business community, but maybe not so much for, say, local environmentalists. Again, political scientist Aubrey Jewett.
If this thing actually works and there are elected officials that emerge out of this that win elections and then presumably are a little even more favorable to business, I suspect other groups, consumer groups, environmental groups, et cetera, would probably try the same sort of thing.
Still, Jewett says the Business Force graduates aren't likely to change the face of Florida politics in a big way, since pro-business politicians already dominate much of the state's political landscape. In Orlando, I'm Judith Smelser for Marketplace.
You think you've got pressure on the job? Imagine running a company that makes and sells products used by more than 3.5 billion people every day, including you, probably, if you use Crest toothpaste, Tide laundry detergent, or Gillette razors. Procter & Gamble is the biggest consumer products company in the world, an $82 billion a year concern. But 8 years ago, it was a different story. Some P&G brands were actually losing market share altogether. So, of course, the board decided to shake things up.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Procter & Gamble CEO A.G. Lafley. When we sat down last week, I asked him how you go about reinventing a 170-year-old company.
Change is probably the only constant that we can count on. Our consumers are changing. When I joined the company in the mid-70s, we were mostly a U.S. company. Today, we are truly a global company. Almost 30% of our sales are in emerging markets.
Give me an example of how that drives product development in this company.
When we go into developing markets in the laundry business, very basic business for us, the way laundry is done is totally different. It's done by hand. It's done in rivers and streams, or it's done by collecting a tub of water from whatever the central water supply is in the village. So we have to deal with a lot of variation in water quality and some not very good water. So we created a product that enables consumers to rinse one time because Once the soil's removed from the fabric, it holds those soils away from the fabric and the dirty wash water.
For most of this company's history, those innovations came from within. I mean, Procter & Gamble was famous for insularity, to be blunt about it, in terms of product development and innovation and grooming of executives and all those things. You have now made the decision, since you've been running this place, to go outside for a lot of those innovations and changes and new ideas. Why?
First of all, we would get a look at a lot more early stage innovation and early stage product prototypes. When we started in 99, 2000, maybe 10 to 15% of the products we brought to market that were new every year had an external partner. Last year, for the first time, half of all the new product innovations we brought to market had one or more external partners. So we've almost doubled, you know, our at-bats, okay?
Right.
And in the innovation game, which is a risky game, more at-bats leads to more hits. It's sort of the Pete Rose approach, okay, to innovation. You get up more times, you get to swing the bat a few more times, you get a few more hits.
Let me continue the baseball analogy here, right? What you're doing, in essence, by outsourcing all this innovation is you're buying innovation, sort of like the New York Yankees buy hits, right?
Well,
Does that make you George Steinbrenner? I don't know.
I don't know. I'll have to think about that analogy. I think what we're doing is we're running a continual tryout camp. I'm sure we look at several new product prototypes literally every day. And from those, our innovation leaders and our businesses choose some that they then try to co-develop.
You write actually in your book that about half of your product innovations fail.
That's right.
It's not so good.
That's the game. In fact, in our industry, 80 to 85% of new products fail in the sense that they're no longer on store shelves, you know, 3 to 5 years after they're introduced. And there's a museum in upstate New York that is full of failed consumer products. And we have our fair share there. So I think we know we're in a game where you fail a lot. Innovation is that kind of a game. And what we're trying to do is improve our success rate. And what we're also trying to do is fail earlier, fail faster, and reallocate the resources from the failures so we can put the money against innovations that have a chance to become a commercial success.
A.G. Lafley is the chairman and CEO of Procter & Gamble. Mr. Lafley, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That book about innovation that I mentioned is called The Game Changer by A.G. Lafley. That's L-A-F-L-E-Y. You can look it up probably on Amazon. We've got more conversations from the corner office on our website. It is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, and it's a study in the contrasting values of brand names. The internet domain name America.com goes up for auction this week. People who analyze these sorts of things say it could fetch a record. If it did, it would beat the $1.1 million that Chinese.com went for last year. The current owner of America.com is an anonymous foreigner. He's not telling how much he paid for the rights to it when he bought it 3 years ago. The current domain name record, by the way, $12 million. Whether America will beat sex.com? Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 41 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 12 points, a half percent. The S&P 500 added 1 point. We'll call that flat. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on this program, expensive copper means stolen copper, which means cities have to pay.
We'll probably be trying to replace and secure the wire that's stolen right now every day for the next, I'd say, year.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
A American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.